You're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. On today's episode, I sit down with Seamus Mullen, chef owner of a couple Spanish restaurants here in New York City, Tortulia, which he opened in 2011 in the West Village, and El Camado, a tapas and wine bar in Gotham Market West in Hell's Kitchen. What makes Seamus so interesting is not just his food, which is delicious, but how he has completely transformed himself these last 5 years by how he cooks and eats and exercises. Seamus suffers from rheumatoid arthritis, and he has managed to basically heal himself, not through drugs and medicine, but through food. And that's the topic of his new book, which comes out in August, Real Food Heals. Eat to feel younger and stronger every day. He is insanely knowledgeable about nutrition and food and ingredients. And so he and I talk about that, how to sort of eat better and live better. All right, let's do this thing. Here's Seamus and I. Seamus, welcome to One World Trade.
Thanks for having me. You know, I went to the wrong building, and I got into an argument with the security guy. I'm like, no, I'm going to Condé Nast. It's right here. He said, dude, it's not in this building.
Did you not know what One World Trade was, the really giant building?
I knew it, but I was on a bicycle, and it's really hard to lock your bike around here. And I remembered there was a bike rack over, not on Vesey Street, but like a couple streets over. And so I went over there and I went into the other building that's right next door that looks from the ground up to be like One World Trade.
Yeah, they're all put a lot of steel and glass. It's actually interesting. And I know we're talking about healthy-ish stuff on this podcast. So many more of my colleagues bike to work now throughout the year. And that was a big issue when we moved into One World Trade 2 years ago. There's like literally 12 bike lockers in the entire building.
Oh, really?
Which drove people bananas.
Buildings with bike lockers?
Well, I think, well, now new ones, like everything's so green and whatnot.
Right.
You know what's amazing? You go to the Stumptown headquarters in Portland, Oregon, and right when you walk in, the first thing is like the bike room. And there's just like racks on racks on racks and bikes hanging from ceilings and everything. Like that's where everyone, because everyone who works there literally rides a bike. It's awesome.
That's awesome. That's great.
The problem with this building is so fortified because of security reasons.
Right.
That there's the entire base of this building, which I think is like 15 stories, is pretty much all concrete. And there's very little room for things like bicycles. So that did not make all the cyclists happy at Condé Nast.
No, it's hard. And it's very hard to find. I mean, there is one bank of bike racks outside, but for the most part, it's really hard around here to find a place to put a bike.
No, I know. And when I do bike, you're basically parking on the street two blocks away and hoping it doesn't get jacked by the time you leave work. You're looking very fit these days.
Oh, thanks.
Jackalus. And it was funny. I was looking at your book, Hero Food, from 2012.
Yeah.
And even then, I'm like, wow, Seamus is a lot like leaner now in the last 4 years.
Yep.
And I do want to talk about how you got to be where you are today, both fitness-wise, diet-wise, how those two sort of work hand in hand. But it goes back to a health crisis that, I mean, I don't know, almost killed you?
Yeah. I mean, I was really sick for a long time. And for a very long time, I was managing it. You know, I was kind of getting by.
And like early 2000s?
Yeah. I mean, I started feeling pretty crappy right around 2001. But I think I actually had been slowly getting sick before that. And I just, there was a lot of stuff that was going on in my health that I didn't realize was indicative of declining general health and of an impending crisis. But by the time by the time I was in my late 20s, I really started to feel pretty crappy all the time. And I didn't really know how to put a label on it other than there were times that I just didn't have very much energy or my hands hurt or my back hurt, my shoulders hurt.
But did you think, and I think this happens with a lot of us, like, oh, well, that's just the way it is. I've been working a lot. Yeah. I'm hungover.
Exactly.
I probably shouldn't have had that cheeseburger last night at midnight. And quote unquote paying the price. And that's just
exactly.
Life.
Yeah. That was initially for a long time. I thought, oh, well, this is just, I work a lot. I work 90 hours a week. I'm a cook.
You're a chef.
Yeah. And then it just kind of got more and more, it became more and more obvious that there was something else going on. And I started having these really, really acute attacks in different joints where, my hand would swell up or my ankles would swell up, my knee would swell up. And it was so painful that it was, you know, undeniable. I remember actually working the line at Brasserie 8.5 in 2005, and I was the executive sous chef there, and I had my shoulder was killing me, and I went to reach for the dupe that was coming off of the printer, and I couldn't move my arm.
That's not good.
Like I looked down and I was looking at my arm, and I was trying to move it, and it wouldn't move, and the pain was terrible. So I ended up going to the hospital, and that was the first of many, many, many trips to the ER. And they did an X-ray. They said there's nothing wrong with me. I didn't have any trauma.
At that point, they didn't know what to look for. They just thought you might have had like a joint problem, or like a bone problem, or some
exactly.
You pulled a muscle or something.
Yeah. So I saw an orthopedic specialist, and they're like, "Well, there's nothing wrong with you. It doesn't look like there's anything on the X-ray." So essentially, they kind of said I was being a hypochondriac. There's nothing really wrong. So they gave me a bunch of pain medication and sent me home. And that happened over and over again.
Anything good?
Unfortunately, yes, because then I ended up really becoming hooked on it for years.
Which is what you hear about athletes all the time. Yeah. Let me ask you a question. This eventually led to some acute incidents, mm-hmm. Which eventually got you to the other side. Mm-hmm. But do you think you would have been in this predicament had you not been a professional chef? And let's just talk about that lifestyle, mm-hmm. and that grind of what was it like when you were a line cook back in those days?
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty rotten. I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, mm-hmm. which is a chronic autoimmune disease. And I've had a lot of people ask me over the years what caused that. And that was my first question when I was diagnosed: what causes this? And I couldn't get a conclusive answer from the medical community because they didn't really have one. And now, in hindsight, looking back, I've learned a lot about autoimmune disease. And I firmly believe there isn't really, in the case of not only autoimmune disease, but a lot of other chronic diseases, you can't pinpoint one thing and say that caused it. And being the life of a cook in New York 15 years ago certainly didn't help.
Yeah. I would say, I mean, it's interesting. My wife is very into Eastern medicine and mm-hmm. how Eastern and Western come together. And that seems a very, very Western thing. People want one answer for things. Yeah. Tell me why. And it's like, well, it's all kind of connected.
Yeah.
And let's say, back in those days, what was your life like? How many hours were you working? Were you going out every night?
Yeah, I was working. I had been in Spain for 2.5 years working there. And that was really, really hard. I mean, this is in the early 2000s when Spain was kind of at the height of its culinary
Fran Adria and all that.
Yeah, everything, and I was working at Muariz in San Sebastian, and we worked 6 days a week. You got to work usually about 8 o'clock in the morning. You worked through lunch service, and after lunch service, you had a break for an hour and a half or so, and then you went back to work and you worked dinner service. And Sunday was a half day.
This being Spain, what time did dinner service wrap up?
Dinner itself wrapped around 1, and then by the time I got out there, it was like 2, and then I would ride my bicycle back home. So I was sleeping like 4 hours a night and working 100 hours a week.
That can't be good for you.
No, there's nothing you can do other than barely survive throughout the whole day. I remember one time working the grill was outside, and I was working the grill, and I remember falling asleep leaning against the grill. I was so tired. And we used to have to go forage for things in the woods and stuff in the mornings. And it was not uncommon to find cooks that were like lying down in the woods sleeping.
Little nymphs.
Yeah.
What was it? So you came back to New York, and you know, New York is a, how should I say, a very social city.
Mm-hmm.
What was the social life of a young chef? Were you going out after work? Like, were you drinking? What was that like?
We worked hard. You'd get out of work at 1 or whatever, or maybe later, and then everybody would go and get drinks, and then you're hungry because you ate family meal at 4 in the afternoon, which is kind of a very bizarre time to eat a lot of food.
Yeah.
And then you go into dinner service, where you're eating a lot of food throughout dinner, but you never
just taste it.
Yeah. You're constantly, I remember for many, many years, I was in this constant state of never being hungry, but never not being hungry. And you're always eating stuff, and you have to, because that's your job. And then you get out of work and you're kind of hungry because you haven't really had a proper meal.
Yeah, you're not satisfied.
No.
It's like being at a cocktail party and you're nibbling and nibbling. And you're like, and after the party's over, you're like, I kind of feel like I should eat dinner, but I'm not really full, but I don't want to go to bed. So then you end up, of course,
eating something. And then when your body should really be resting and recovering, it's digesting or dealing with the impending hangover that's coming or whatever it might be. So, we would go out a lot. I would say pretty much every night after work.
Eight nights a week.
Exactly. You go out and get drinks, and then there's probably a slice of pizza, or then there's you're going to like Corner Bistro and getting a burger or whatever it is. You know,
but that's what's so funny. People think like, oh, if you're like a fancy chef, you eat really well.
No, you don't. You eat terribly.
Yeah. And you have four things in your refrigerator.
Yeah, exactly. Home. Yeah. And one of them is mayonnaise. And God knows how long it's been there. Yeah. No. So we'd go out and then pretty much every night go out, get a drink, get something to eat. And then most nights, like four nights a week, going out, meeting up with other people from other restaurants and staying out pretty late.
Yeah. So I mean, it's interesting now, you know, I see certain chefs who haven't had this sort of life change moment like you mm-hmm. have. And you're like, wow, you don't look so good. You can just tell because it wears on you, man.
It's not sustainable. I mean, I think that there's some people that can continue to survive despite it for a really long time. But eventually, you know, your body's going to break down. It's too hard to be out till 4 a.m, four nights, five nights a week, and then go back and work a 10, 12-hour day.
Yeah. I mean, there's the few Keith Richards types out there who somehow
break the mold.
Yeah, but that's just a weird genetic sort of freak moment. So when did everything come to a head for you?
So it really came to a head in 2007. And I would say that was probably like the moment that was the most critical. And I ended up being hospitalized with really, really severe pain in my left hip. And after being in the hospital for a week trying to figure out what was going on with this, they discovered that my hip was full of fluid, which is why I was in so much pain. Because as the femur kind of moves out of the pelvis, the sciatic nerve gets stretched. And then it was just like, you know, it's incredibly painful.
What type of doctor eventually accurately?
A rheumatologist.
Rheumatologist.
Yeah. So I was in the hospital at Beth Israel, and they kind of sent out this. Initially, they thought I actually had a septic hip, that I had an infection in my hip because my white blood cell count was so high.
How freaked out were you at this point?
I was really freaked out. I also was really just in so much pain that I just wanted some answers.
Yeah.
So I didn't know. I had no idea what was causing all of this. And when they initially thought I had a septic hip, I actually they sedated me and I ended up in the operating room. They were going to do what's called a pelvic evacuation, or where they kind of split you open and they just scrub it out, because if you have a septic hip, it can go to your spinal cord and to your brain and kill you. I had a moment where I woke up in the operating room and I was literally prepped for surgery, and my brother was there.
Have you ever watched Westworld?
I watched a little bit of it. Yeah, sort of like that. Yeah.
Where the robots wake up on the table.
Exactly. Like, where am I? Yeah. Wasn't I just shooting a six-shooter?
Yeah.
So my brother was there and I asked him what was going on. Apparently they had decided while I was unconscious that they needed to perform the surgery. And my brother convinced the doctors to perform a culture of what was going on in my hip in the OR. And they didn't see any bacteria growing, mm-hmm. any unusual bacteria. And so he said, listen, I don't want you to do this. And
was he a medically knowledgeable fellow at all?
No. Or he's like, you know, he grew up on a farm like me in Vermont.
Just a dude from Vermont. Yeah, exactly. That's a pretty smart move, though.
Yeah. No, but I owe my brother my life for many reasons. But he definitely said, listen, we can't let this happen. It's going to change Seamus's life for the rest of his life.
You know?
Unless we have 100% certainty that that's what's going on, I don't want you to cut into him. And when they found that there was no infection, they reached out to all the departments in the hospital to see if anyone knew what could cause that kind of inflammation without an infection. And that's where the chair of rheumatology came back and said, I think he might have RA. Let me look at him. Sounds like an autoimmune response. And the funny thing is that now autoimmune disease, AI disease, and all that's it's very common.
Yeah.
People they're common terms where people are familiar with it, even rheumatoid arthritis. But this is 10 years ago, and I didn't even really know what autoimmune disease was. I had no concept of what an AI disease was. I had never heard of RA before. So he said, listen, I'm going to run some tests. He diagnosed me and eventually gave me this diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis, which I was like, okay, that's great. I've never heard of that. And he walked out of the room and I started Googling it and immediately was like,
don't ever Google.
Dr. Google told me that I was never going to work again. I was going to be in a wheelchair. I was going to be on meds for the rest of my life.
And some really gnarly pictures.
Yeah, some very, very gnarly pictures. So fortunately, that didn't happen, although that could have happened if I hadn't made a change in my life.
Okay, so you at least know what the problem is. in a way, that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's the first step to solving the problem.
Yep.
Most Americans, I would imagine, they get diagnosed. They say, what drug do I take? Mm-hmm. And they get a prescription, and their doctor tells them what to take every day, and then they start taking drugs,
yeah.
And that's that. You decided out of the gate not to go that route, or what happened?
No. I mean, I started with the conventional allopathic treatment, mm-hmm. which was conservatively, it started with anti-inflammatories and prednisone, which now in hindsight, I can't believe that prednisone is a conservative treatment. Mm-hmm. I was on it for many, many years.
Did your health insurance cover everything? Or
yeah, I think for the most part, things like missing work and taxis.
Yeah.
You know, when barely being able to get out of bed and things like that. So I started with conventional treatment. That I went down the road of doing that and just sort of accepting that I was going to be a sick person for the rest of my life. And I settled into this life of just functioning and getting by as somebody who was on pretty heavy duty meds. And I definitely I felt really sorry for myself. I had this sense of like, why me? I didn't deserve this. This is bullshit. You know, I can't believe I have to fucking live with this. I'm in so much pain all the time.
And career-wise, where were you at this point?
I had opened Boca Carrera on 19th Street, and so it was my first job as an executive chef and as a partner in a restaurant.
But you were still able, and that's a really delicious modern Spanish restaurant that was very popular, mm-hmm. and did really well out of the gate. So you were still able to think creatively and enthusiastically about food.
Yeah, I mean,
hard was that though?
My life was.
Did you have an appetite?
Yeah, I did. I definitely had an appetite. I mean, I ate a lot. My life was work and dealing with disease.
Yeah.
So that was pretty much the entirety of it. And to me, work was also going out and partying with my friends and doing all that.
So you were still doing that?
I was still doing that because
shouldn't have been, I imagine.
No, but I mean, it's really hard when you're dealing with chronic pain, you feel like shit all the time. And someone tells you, you have to drink a green juice and you have to do yoga every day and blah. And you do those things and you don't feel any better.
Yeah.
It's like, what's the point? I might as well eat ice cream and go out and party and get wasted, and at least I have enjoy myself. I have some modicum of pleasure. And it really, you know, I continued in that direction for a really long time. And taking all the meds that I was on until I got to the point where my health really, really started to break down. I mean, I was in the hospital all the time. And then eventually I developed an infection in my brain, which was probably the result of being on immunosuppressants.
I would just say this. This is probably, I'm looking at Emma, my producer, probably our most unappetizing podcast to date so far.
We're going to talk about cupcakes and candy in a minute.
No, we're going to talk about delicious food shortly. Yeah. All right. So you almost die again.
Yes. So this is the major one. This is when I really almost die. And then I come out of there and have this moment where I see the light and all of that. And I think it's going to be over. And I realize something's got to give. I've got two choices. Either I change or I die. And I was lucky kind of coming out of that to
what year is this now?
This is 5 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like 2012.
Yeah. And I mean, leading up to this, I knew that there was a correlation between food and my health, and I was figuring it out sort of, but I wasn't really making much progress. I was getting there. And when I came out of that, I met this great doctor, Dr. Frank Lipman, who practices functional medicine.
My wife is, yeah.
Yeah, she's I'm sure she follows Frank. And Frank was like, listen, I want to work with you. I don't want to treat RA. I want to treat whatever is causing RA. So just like if you look at a tree and the leaves are brown, you don't paint the leaves green. You address the root system and you look at what the underlying causes. And so he started to draw this picture of all the different things in my life, the factors that might have led to creating an environment in which my immune system could go awry. And certainly the hard driving life of being a cook was part of it, partying part of it, but also overuse of antibiotics, infection, bad choices about diet. Like there are not a lot of things that really, I think, impacted, created the environment that was right for disease to thrive in my body. He said, listen, I want to work with you. You're going to have to do all the work. I'm not really going to do anything. It's going to be on you. But you're going to get better. And no doctor had ever said that to me. Every doctor said, we're going to manage your disease and it's something you're going to live with for the rest of your life. And, you know, remission is a possibility, but not something that we can expect.
Did you go off drugs wholesale at that point and saying, let's start a new
program? I slowly did.
Yeah.
I had to slowly go off drugs. I couldn't. It took a year and change to get off of drugs. But also it took a year for me to completely reverse all of the symptoms of RA and then all of the biological markers for it. So if you were to look at my bloods now, there's no indication that I have an autoimmune dysfunction at all.
So you came out with Hero Foods in 2012, about 18 ingredients that can sort of change the way you feel and live. You have a new book coming out in August.
Yeah, it's called Real Food Heals. Eat to feel younger and stronger every day.
All right, so let's get to the delicious portion of the podcast.
Yes.
I know, listen, you're a wonderfully talented chef. You make really delicious food. How do we eat well and also feel well? Because as you said, I don't want to just drink green juice all day.
No.
I don't want to eat wassa crackers with some labneh on it.
No.
I want to eat some good food also.
Yeah. Well, so the good news is that with a couple of broad strokes, there's like a bazillion things you can eat that are really, really good and they're good for us. And I think that I changed the way that I looked at the relationship I have with food. And I really started to understand that the choices I make about food directly impact not only how I feel, but actually the person that I become every moment. Because we're constantly, you know, regenerating cells. We're creatures in motion. We're always evolving. And to really do that well, you have to have a very good relationship with food, not an antagonistic relationship with food. And there's so many foods that are, we call comfort foods, that actually make us really uncomfortable. And we may not even realize that
after we eat them.
And there's like a nostalgic element, which I totally can appreciate. But the reality is that I tend to go towards the things that I really, you know, that make me feel. I mean, I'm just thinking about like what I had last night for dinner, for instance.
What'd you have?
I had green papaya salad with fermented shrimp. I had pork chop.
What kind of pork chop and from where?
It was a Berkshire pork chop from my kitchen.
Just grilled up nice and simple?
Yeah, simple, yeah, with a little bit of fish sauce and lime. What else did I have? That might have been it, actually.
Yeah.
But so really,
are you not a big carb guy?
So I don't eat well, there's carbs in that, but I don't eat simple carbs. So I don't eat bread and I don't eat grains and I eat a little bit of rice, but not that much.
I ran into you at this golf event we did last summer, and I asked you a lot of these questions about sort of getting fit while also eating well for those of us who don't have an autoimmune disease. My challenge with what you were telling me was, A, fully understanding it, because you go deep on the food science and medicine here, but also, like, I can't not eat carb.
Our metabolisms didn't evolve to eat carbs. We didn't start eating carbohydrates.
But then why do we like them so much?
Well, because they have the same sort of effect on our neurological system as drugs do. And they're very satisfying in many ways quickly. And the problem is that carbs impact our metabolism the same way that sugars do. In order to break down the glucose into glycogen, we need to produce insulin. So our pancreas produces insulin.
Dude, this is where you started to lose my
Glass. I won't go too deep into it. But essentially, if you can imagine, when you eat carbs or you eat sugar, your blood sugar spikes and you feel good.
Yeah,
but
for then like 15 minutes.
It depends on what kind of sugar it is. Like if it's sugar that's in an orange, it's going to be slow. Whereas if it's just orange juice, it's going to be really fast.
Yeah.
So your blood sugar goes up and you feel pretty good, but then eventually you're going to need more of it. And when you don't have it, when you take that out of your diet, because it's a regular part of your diet, your body is constantly going to be looking for that to produce glycogen so you have energy. But as you start to change your metabolism, which is very doable, I mean, for instance, what time is it? It's like noon. I haven't eaten since 7 o'clock yesterday. I feel fine.
You didn't have breakfast this morning?
No, I almost never have breakfast.
I've heard it's the most important meal of the day. People say that.
I've heard it's the most oversold meal.
Wow. Yeah. Don't tell the breakfast board.
No, I think the most important meal of the day is the first meal you eat, whether you eat it at 6 in the morning, you eat it at 3 in the afternoon. I think it is the most important meal that you eat because it sets your metabolism up for that day.
What did you have a harder time getting off of, French fries or ice cream?
Probably French fries.
Yeah.
And I'm not off ice cream.
Oh.
Yeah.
How can you not be off? I thought you're off sugar.
Yeah. I don't eat sugar regularly, but I'm not going to be sanctimonious and say I don't ever eat sugar.
So how often do you not eat sugar?
I eat ice cream maybe once a week, a little bit of ice cream once a week. And also because of the fat in ice cream, fat is really good for you. Good fat is good for you.
Well, let's talk about good fat, because in your book, the first book, you talk about lamb fat being good for you.
Sure.
Is not all fat the same?
Not all fat is created equal, no. So
can we talk about that? Because I like fat.
Yeah, fat is good. Okay, well, fat is nutrient dense. I mean, the whole reason that we started demonizing fat is because it has more calories than carbohydrates.
Okay.
And so we had this notion. It was started by a guy named Ansel Keys. Keys in the 1950s that a calorie is a calorie. So if you're eating 1 gram of fat versus 1 gram of carbohydrates, you're getting more calories in the fat than you are in the carbohydrates. So better eat the carbohydrates because it's this notion of like you put gas into a car and you can drive it until you run out of gas. And the problem with that is that you're taking a physical law, a law of physics. Energy cannot be created or destroyed, and you're applying it to the system, the biological system of the body. And things happen in the body when you put fuel in. It gets converted into all different things. So imagine like putting sugar into your body, and then like you get 25% usage out of it, and the other 75% stays in the body essentially as fat. When you put fat into the body, good fat, your body uses it. It uses it, and you probably don't need as much of it, and it's very satisfying. So, you know, it's easy to eat a whole bag of potato chips. It's really hard to eat, like, a whole bag of avocados.
I've never eaten a whole bag of lamb chops, for instance.
Or a whole bag of lamb chops.
I will say this. I made lamb chops the other day for my wife and me. Went to Italy over here, bought 4 little lamb rib chops.
Mm-hmm. Mm, I love those.
Not cheap, but I only bought 4, so I think there was, like, $26 a pound, and I basically bought 2 double chops, so it was like about $26 for the 2 of us, which is not bad, $13 each. But what's interesting, I was looking at them and I was like, should I get the 3rd chop so we each have 3 chops, or is it enough that we each only have 2 chops? Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know what? Time to practice what I preach. I'm only going to get the 2 chops because they were so well marbled. There was so much fat in there that I knew that fat was going to be so satisfying as you're gnawing the bone and you like crisp them up in the pan with a little rosemary. And they were so delicious, and we had a little Greek salad, and I made some tzatziki, and we had some brown rice, and it was delicious.
See, that's
meal.
That's awesome, yeah. You know? And if you can like if you can make the Greek salad really really big, and the brown rice a really small portion of the lamb.
I keep on going back to the brown rice. I'm like, I need that thing to fill me up. How do you get sated though if you don't? That's what I don't understand. Like if I don't have brown rice, or if I don't have French fries, or if I don't have some sort of carbiness, like I feel like there's like this hole that's not filled in my stomach.
Yeah. Also, no two humans are created equally. We're all different. And so for some people, that is the case, that they run better on some carbohydrates than other people. But I think that you can change it up. But yeah, the fat thing is, I mean, that's great. That's exactly, I believe in the whole idea of eat less, better meat.
Yeah.
You know,
and it's more satisfying.
Yeah, eat a little bit, and that leaves you kind of remembering how good it is, and the bone is awesome because then you do gnaw on the bone, and so you're continually satisfying that desire.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
All right, let's talk about diet and fitness / athletics. You've gotten hardcore into cycling over the last several years. I know you lead these trips in throughout Europe, which I want to go on one of these.
Come with me, man.
Yeah.
Come with me. I got a great one in Sicily in June.
I haven't been on a bike trip since I was 15, but maybe I can get into shape.
I'm sure you'd be fine.
Talk about your diet when you're sort of, you know, in the city and your Tertullio and stuff compared to your diet when you're biking 100 miles a day or something. You know, like how do you eat differently?
I don't really eat that much differently. I mean, the reality is I feel like when you're eating for health, you're eating for performance too. So if you're eating well, which means you're eating nutrient-dense foods, lots of vegetables, lots of good healthy fats, you know, a small amount of natural sugar is fine. It's not going to kill you. It's not necessarily great for you. Same thing goes with alcohol. Like small amount of alcohol is fine. You know, no big deal. If I'm on the bike and I'm going to do a really, really long ride, I will eat a bigger breakfast before that.
You'll increase your calorie intake for the day.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. And I mean, you know, when I do like a 120 mile ride, just to put it in perspective, that's like a 5,000 kilojoule rise. I mean, it's like 5,000 kilojoules is essentially how we measure how hard that you work. It means how much power you've produced over the period of the ride, which equates, is interesting in cycling, a kilojoule nicely
that,
equates to exactly.
Is that like J-E-W-E-L or no?
No, J-O-U-E-L.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. I can't spell it in my head. It's more or less like that. So it's a measurement of power. That equates nicely to one calorie. So 5,000 kilojoules is like 5,000 calories. Wow. That's a lot. And most people, you know, you think, oh, it worked out. I burned like 100 calories. So you're not creating a caloric deficit when you go and run on the treadmill unless you're doing it for like, you know, a marathon runner for 3 or 4 hours. But on a bicycle, if you go out and ride 120 miles really hard, you will create a caloric deficit and you need to replenish those calories. You can't just...
What if you're trying to lose weight though?
It's not an effective way of losing weight. Exercise is the most, I would say one of the most ineffective ways of losing weight.
Yeah, you see, you mentioned this last time. I don't understand. Don't you, isn't that how you burn calories and you need to have fewer calories coming in than
no,
going out?
No, you don't.
Out?
That's the food pyramid from the 1950s. That's the notion that we are a system where you just kind of put gas in the tank and burn what's there. A calorie in and a calorie out. If you're trying to create, I mean, to give you perspective, 5,000 calories is probably like a quarter pound of body fat.
Okay.
So if you want to lose 10 pounds, that means you have to be creating a 20,000 calorie deficit for 20 days.
Okay, but
impossible.
So then how do people lose weight? How does, like, I have friends, like, I was, you know, like talking to Brad in the test kitchen, Brad Leone, we just saw. Brad stopped drinking beer for a couple of weeks and he lost 10 pounds.
Yeah. How big did, surprise.
But isn't that because he has fewer calories coming
no,
in?
No, it's because beer is carbohydrates and sugar. And when you eat carbohydrates and sugar,
is that why it tastes so good?
Part of why, yeah, and then alcohol is in there. And then the socializing is why it tastes so good too. But yeah, I mean, what happens is when you eat sugars and carbohydrates, your body converts them into white fat, essentially. Whatever you can't use gets converted into white fat for hibernation. for a rainy day when you need to have it. And we're all walking around, even if you're super lean, we're all walking around with thousands and thousands of calories that we could access if we knew how to, if our bodies knew how to, which is what we used to, you know, 10, 15,000 years ago, our bodies knew how to access those calories really well. Which is why people can go very, very long periods of time without eating, but they can't go long periods of time without drinking. Mm. And they can't go very long without air.
No, I like
so,
that. Big fan.
So, yeah, so exactly, air is a good thing. So to lose weight from exercise, it's really difficult. What you can do is you can change the way that your metabolism works depending upon the exercise that you do. And obviously, exercise and strength building, for instance, creates muscle tone, which changes the way you look slightly.
Yes.
But what tends to happen is that when people adopt the healthy habit of exercising, they think twice about the food choices they're making. And so we tend to – it's one of those things like we talk about disease being contagious, but I think health is actually even more contagious.
Ooh, I like that. So is that in your book? Do you
use
that?
I probably said it at some point. It's not
that's
the first time
one.
I said it. But it's true. I do believe it. Like the more – when you – good decisions beget more good decisions.
Yeah, totally. It's, and you feel good and you don't want to put something in your body that makes you feel not good.
Yeah, exactly.
So but in terms of like – so losing weight, it's more about diet than exercise.
It's entirely about diet. And exercise helps to reinforce diet.
Let me ask you a question. All right. So let's say most of us don't bike 120 miles on the reg. We work in big office buildings like this one. What are some basic things we should or should not be doing to help ourselves sort of feel better on a weekly basis?
Well, one thing is you should be drinking a lot of water.
Okay,
do that. Yeah, that's a really good thing to do. Drink a lot of water. I think exercise is really, really important, and I do it, you know, pretty much every day in some capacity. I think using your body, it's my friend Bill Gifford wrote this great book called How to Live Forever or Die Trying. And that's the subtitle. I can't remember the title of the book. It's an awesome book. Anyway, and I was so mad at him though, because when I got to the end of the book, I realized like the whole secret is he could have summed it up in one sentence, use it or lose it. So the human body gets really good at doing whatever the human body does. If you do nothing or sit in a chair all the time, it gets really good at sitting in a chair. So if you're at a desk job, move around, stand up. Sit down, squat, sit on the floor. Don't always sit in a chair.
Yeah.
I think sitting on the floor is good, like when you have a meeting and forcing everybody to sit on the floor. Beanbags.
And then what about, okay, for us office workers, in terms of diet, what we eat when or how much when? Is it still lunches, have a big lunch and small dinner, or what's your philosophy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, and this is ironic because I'm a chef and what I do is peddle food, but I think it's really important to embrace hunger. I think it's important to understand hunger and understand it. I absolutely hate that fucking term, hangry, because hangry is such a it's just a symptom of everything that's wrong with our relationship with food.
I don't think that there's, speaking of my wife again, there's no term that better describes Simone. I mean, she, when she's hangry, like,
she's hangry. Yeah,
get out of the way.
Yep, and that, I mean, that's you know. In cycling, we call it bonking, when your blood sugar drops really, really low and you can't think properly. You just have to have food. That's usually happens when you're you're not.
Wait, sorry to interrupt, but when you're on one of these 120-mile rides, what do you have, like, bananas with you? Do you have power bars with you? What are you eating while you're on the bike?
Well, I have been known to pull a can of sardines out of my jersey before. cured meat, sausages.
So more protein-y.
Yeah, protein and fat. I mean, I do, like, I'll have some dried fruit. And there are a lot of manufacturers of bars that have very low in sugar that have natural ingredients and don't have stabilizers in them.
But if you get my thing and my feeling is...
Oh, almond butter. That's what I eat, though, all the time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, almond butter is what I eat on the bike all the time.
Not as flavorful as peanut butter, though.
Oh, man, a little bit of maple syrup in the almond butter is very good.
Oh, well, sure. I mean,
but you don't need very much, though, just a little bit and some sea salt.
But if my experience is when you get noticeably hungry, you then end up eating more aggressively.
Depends on what you eat.
Like when I was in college and I was really hungry, I'd get a super burrito, carnitas burrito at Gordo Burrito in Berkeley, and I would just wolf the entire thing bag of chips, and next thing I know, I'm like on the sofa.
Right,
like
exactly. Because if you were to look at the macros of that, it was like 80% carbohydrates.
But it's so good.
It's so good. Yeah, it tastes good. But then you feel terrible and you're bloated forever.
But how do you not stuff yourself if you're embracing hunger? You're like, oh man, I'm starved. I'm going to go to town on this.
Well, you can. I mean, like, I have every day at lunch, I have the big ass salad. And I have a massive big ass salad.
Is that on the menu?
Well, yeah.
Big ass salad?
I call it the BAS. Yeah, in some capacity it is. There always is. So, a big salad with a lot of vegetables.
So what's in today's salad, for instance?
Oh, today's salad.
It's
January, so we'll have bitter greens. So there'll be some Castelfranca and some radicchio. There'll probably some kale and some other lettuce in it. Then there's going to be some pickled squash in it, maybe some persimmon. I'm going to have a little bit of fruit, some nuts, avocado, seeds. And I might, throw some grilled chicken in there too.
Yeah. Is it typically good to have some sort of protein in there? Could you do an egg also?
You could have an egg. Egg is awesome. Egg is like the perfect food in the world. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think when you have protein and nutrients, you got to have fat.
Yeah.
Because fat helps you absorb those nutrients.
Where do you fall on cheese? I never understood if I'm cheese good, bad. I never know. How does cheese work?
It depends on the individual. If some people don't react well to cheese, obviously, if you're lactose intolerant or you have trouble with certain cheeses, then obviously stay away from them. Cheese has fat in it, has protein in it, and it has sugar in it. So it really kind of depends on how you feel about the cheese. If you're really trying to lose weight, and you go into you heard about nutritional ketosis.
No.
Okay. that's a deep dive. But if you're really trying to – that nutritional ketosis is when you only eat fat and you keep your carbohydrates below 100 grams a day.
Yeah.
And cheese factors into that. And what you end up doing is you're turning your body into a fat-burning machine.
But on a day-to-day regular diet, is there certain types of cheese that are theoretically, quote-unquote, better for you than other types?
Like
more aged or
I think that, yeah, anything raw, that's raw is good.
Yeah.
I'm not a big fan of altering natural ingredients. So while I understand that it's good not to die from a bacterial infection, at the same time, I think that we inoculate way too much and we over-pasteurize things and we take a lot of the nutritional quality out of raw ingredients by doing that for the sake of so-called safety. So cheese is, where do I land on cheese? It's up. I eat cheese not a whole lot. I don't eat it every day. It's delicious. Cheese is great. I also think that the quality of the cheese, choose good cheese.
Yeah. And good meat.
Enjoy, and good meat. Yeah. And just eat it in moderation. Yeah.
All right, Seamus, before we let you go, first of all, a new book comes out in August.
In August, yeah. It's called Real Food Heals. It comes out. It's published by Avery. And I'm super excited. It's actually available for pre-sale on Amazon now. So everybody can get a copy.
Excellent.
In advance at discount.
Amazon.com. It's a place you go buy stuff.
Yep.
You got any TV stuff coming out we should know about?
Let's see. Probably, I was just on the Today Show last week. I do a lot of stuff like that.
Yeah,
yeah. So I've got some more Today Show segments coming up.
Look around, you'll see them.
Yeah.
But before we let you go, we got our lightning round.
Yes.
Either or.
Yes. We got to talk about Healthy-ish too.
Oh, Healthiest, our new website, yeah, launched by BonAppetit.com, called BEHealthyish.com, is where you can find it. Also, Healthy_ish, like on Instagram. Mm-hmm. Instagram feed's a lot of fun. We launched it last week, and going into this, I was like, we need to get Seamus to do a column for this. Mm-hmm. After I ran into you last summer, and you started talking about all this stuff in a way that I was like, wow, that's fascinating, and you obviously can explain things really well. What's your first column about?
So my first column is about is a little bit about my story and kind of outlines my nutritional philosophy. And then it's about what I think in many ways embodies my belief about food in one dish.
Mm. What so is that dish this time?
Do you want me to tell you?
Yeah, it's a spoiler. Yeah, sure. Okay, so, yeah.
All right, so
bring
it's
it on.
So because the world needs another avocado dish.
Mm. You know what? The world does. I would eat avocado. I do eat avocados. You can't get sick of them.
So this is crushed avocado. It's crushed up with lime juice, with ginger, and with anchovy.
Ooh, ginger, fresh
anchovy.
Ginger. Ooh, okay.
Yeah, fresh ginger, anchovy.
You might have lost me on the anchovies, but keep going.
Oh, I know. But when you have it, you'll love it.
I know.
And cilantro, and then it has shaved kohlrabi that's dressed with avocado oil and lime juice. And it's really, really good.
Do you serve it with something, or how?
Yeah, so the idea is like kind of like chips and guacamole, but mm-hmm. instead of using chips, you're using vegetables.
Oh, interesting.
And it's really, really tasty, really satisfying, and it is good for your microbiome, which is very important for your gut bacteria.
Mm.
It is low in low inflammatory dish, so there's not going to be any inflammatory response to it, and it's really dense in micronutrients and healthy fat, so it's kind of the perfect dish.
All right, so this will be a regular recurring column mm-hmm. on Healthy-ish. Well, there'll be some writing. There'll be a recipe each time.
Yep.
Check it out, BeHealthyish.com. Look for it, on the reg. All right.
That's right. All right,
speed now round. Are we ready for speed
We're
round.
Ready for speed round.
Lightning round. It's even faster, although it's halftime. It's not fast. We just talk about
right.
it.
I got to stretch. Hold on. Got to make sure I'm ready. Okay, go.
Okay. Boquerones or anguiles?
Anguiles.
Anguilas.
Anguilas. I'm going to say boquerones, though.
Explain boquerones.
Boquerones are pickled anchovies.
How do you like them, straight or?
In a bazillion different ways.
This is a question from Andrew Knowlton, our resident cyclist nerd.
Yes.
Steel or carbon?
Oh, man. Everyone's going to hate me. Carbon.
That's a frame, carbon yep. frame. Why, carbon why would frame. Why would people hate you? I'm not a cycling guy.
Oh, because like the nerds are like, steel is real, man.
Steel is
but
real.
The reality is that carbon is a modern material, although I just built up an aluminum bike.
How many bikes do you own?
Probably 12.
Oh, my God.
15.
You kidding me? A lot. Iberico ham or chorizo?
Come on, Iberico. The best.
My accent is just...
He's okay, no worries.
And you add, but with Iberico, typically, correct me if I'm wrong, that's usually hand carved, whereas mm-hmm. Prosciutto is
cut on the machine. Yeah,
machine.
But there's lots of other things that make it different.
Yeah,
yeah.
No, like that's
a whole other podcast.
Yeah. Barca or Real Madrid?
Barca.
Have you always been a Barca guy?
Yep.
Do you watch the games on the weekend and stuff? Try to?
Not that often, but I'm kind of a Johnny come lately when it comes to sports. Like I enjoy doing them more than watching them.
Yeah.
Except for cycling, I follow cycling really closely.
Yeah, it's probably better for you. Arborino or Chocoli?
Chocoli.
I love that. Zippy. Yep. It's a zippy wine.
And it has theater in the way it's poured.
Oh, is that where they do the whole...
Yeah, it's called La Escancia, where they pour it from a pie to aerate it, but it also creates a little bit of theater.
I was at some old school restaurant in D.C. years ago, back in my young single days, and them, like, doing it super high, but pouring it on the side of your nose that went in your mouth. Yes.
Oh, my God.
So you kind of tilted your head over, and they had the spout, and they would go higher and higher and higher.
Oh, my God. That sounds awful.
That was a fun night.
You sure that was a tradition, or it just happened?
I don't know. It happened, though.
The guy got drunk.
Climber or sprinter?
Oh, sprinter. Mm. Without a doubt.
Climbing just sounds miserable. Going up, you always watch the Tour de France, like, oh, they're climbing this mountain in the Alps. I'm like, that looks like the most painful, miserable
it's
thing
horrible.
Ever. For
it's,
hours.
It's yeah, and it's like, for I'm a big guy, so it's mathematically, it's very challenging.
Spanish tortilla or really creamy French scrambled eggs?
Yeah, I'm going to go with creamy French
Yes, you
scrambled
are.
Eggs.
Yes, you are. Yes, nicely done. Correct answer. Cider or cava?
I'm gonna go with cider.
When ordering Spanish cider, any advice you want to give the listeners what to look for?
Be wary of the fact that it's going to be very dry. It's not sweet. Spanish cider is very, very dry.
Okay.
And like many other Spanish beverages, like sherry, for instance, it's an acquired taste. It's rare that someone has it the first time, like, oh, I love this. It's usually like, oh, that's interesting. But if you have it with some, yeah, which we know what that means. But if you have it with some blue cheese, or you have it with some almonds, or you have it with some chorizo, it starts to make a lot of sense. So it works really well with food.
And more as an aperitivo sort of thing than sitting down to a full meal. Awesome. Yeah. All right, last question. Butter or olive oil?
Oh, man.
Wow, pregnant pause.
Oh, man. The earliest me would say butter, then the early chef in me would say olive oil, and now I'd say I can't live without either. I know it doesn't.
Emma, are we accepting that as an answer? Or she just said no.
Yeah. Okay, can I blend them up together? like the parquet.
I like when you sort of use the pan and you put some olive oil in the pan with the butter so the butter doesn't burn.
I do that all the time, so that's how I make my scrambled eggs.
All right. There you go.
I'm going to have to say olive oil. Because
Spanish
olive oil, because it's a little more versatile than butter. But that said, I think really good quality butter from grass-fed milk is a very, very healthy ingredient to cook with.
Thank you for telling us. All right, Seamus Mullen, everyone. Thanks for coming out.
Thanks for having me.
This podcast has been brought to you by Carrie Polis, Emma Wertzman, and Lily Sherman, with editing by Mitra Kaboli. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Gradys. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.